I think most of you have met me before, but I'm Lynn Murphy, the past chair of the Elderberries. And on behalf of Elderberries, I'd like to welcome you all to the first Elderberry Salon of 2025. And we have a historical topic, the first Halifax Pride March. And that's an important date in the history of the Halifax two-spirited LGBTQ community. Nowadays we all say 2S LGBTQ, but in the 1980s we mostly said gay. So to set the stage, historically speaking, I'm going to do the same. For many years, we've celebrated the first Gay Pride March of 1988. But actually, the first Halifax Gay Pride March was held in the summer of 1987. It was coordinated by a 21-year-old Dalhousie student and member of the Gay Alliance for Equality. And here he is, slightly older, to tell the story of the earliest Pride March. Nathan Elling.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you very much.
So, Nathan, how did you come to be the coordinator of the first Halifax Pride March?
Well, I wasn't the only coordinator, for sure. Anne Bishop and Maureen Shabib were both involved. And really, I think it was more a collaboration. To set the stage a little bit, they had been involved in, I think it was Take Back the Night March.
Yes.
Which I might have known them through, my friend Janine was also in, this straight friend Janine was also involved in that. I might have known them from that. And at the time, I would have been, I think I was the treasurer at the time for GAE, the Gay Alliance for Equality, before it was the Gay and Lesbian Alliance. Yeah. Which was the next year, I believe. And so they wanted money. and I think coordination with the other groups, various groups in the gay and lesbian sort of oeuvre of the time. So, and I was involved in about 12 of them, I think, total. I mean, it was crazy. There was CKDU, The Word Is Out, there was Gays and Lesbians at Dow, there was all these different things that I was doing. So waves, all kinds of stuff. So I think that's really how it came together. They handled quite a lot of the logistics. I think they were the first ones to go to the police for a permit, which the police denied, and then they asked me to try to do it through GAE, and they still denied us the permit because it wasn't enough time or some not real excuse like that. So we didn't have a permit. We did this. This was a kind of like those San Francisco pop-up protests, you know. We just did it, and we walked on the sidewalk because we figured they couldn't arrest us for walking down the sidewalk, whereas, you know, we would be blocking traffic otherwise.
This is just a little side note here, because Women Reclaim the Night was already in existence.
Yes.
And we always marched on the sidewalk because we didn't want to be beholden to the gay male establishment for permission to reclaim the night. And so some of us who were involved with that said to the GAE gala, well, we didn't get arrested for walking on the sidewalk, yeah, so probably you guys will be all right.
Yeah.
And we marched in the middle of the night, too.
Yes, that's right. That's right. It's the gay male establishment. It's interesting. When we met, I remember, I think it was Anne, I got this impression from her that she thought of me as like the man, like, you know, the patriarchy or something, which was hysterically funny to me, but because I wasn't, but I can see where she got it from. I probably looked the part, you know, and
he was 21, he looked.
I was a 17. Preppy. I was a preppy. I looked, yeah, there's no... But I came to the whole idea of pride. Basically, what was going on at the time, just to give some context, is the Buchanan government was in power. There were a bunch of different things going on. There was sort of the constant violence that we saw in our community in the 80s anyway, that had been going on forever. My friend Arthur, for instance, wasn't really like a hustler or anything, but he would go, he was one of those people who would go to Citadel Hill and stuff and sometimes come back with bruises, you know, or people shouting at him, you know, faggot or whatever it was at the time. Then there was Eric Smith, who had just recently been kind of run out of his community, and he was not a close friend, but a personal friend. I knew him at the time, and I remember this frantic call from somebody. You know, they want to do an interview about gay rights, and we don't have anybody to do the interview because we could all lose our jobs, which was a real thing.
Yeah.
And it was like, we want you to do it, basically, because you have nothing to lose. Which was sort of true and sort of not true. I'll touch on that in a second. So I did two interviews. We talked about Eric Smith in both of them, one for CTV and one for CBC. And I hadn't really done anything like that before. I had to ask my boss at work for time off from work, which she granted. I found out later she had a gay son, but she was just a really great ally. But then the next day when I came in, first of all, I was getting looks on the street, which is freaky, because it was, you know, province-wide. And then I came in and they're like, well, I saw you on TV last night, and I was like, oh yeah, how was I? Because I didn't want them to know it affected me. But we got sidelined. Our entire small little group, Carol, the boss that I was talking about, and myself and two other people, were moved to a whole other office a month later. Out of our little, it was a trust company, so it was a, you know, our little office, our main offices, they sent us to a little satellite office, which I think Carol actually liked. But that was the type of thing that would happen, you know. So it did affect me on a job level, and I'm sure it affected her on a job level, but not in a, you know, we were out of the way in a small little office off the, you know, side where nobody would ever see us kind of thing, because we did bonds and stuff. And then the last thing that was going on, Kevin Crombie, who was a reporter, I can't remember who for, it might have been CBC.
Canadian Press, CP.
Oh, CP, yes, Canadian Press, that's right. He was reporting back to us that they were having discussions in the legislature about doing basically concentration camps for people with AIDS. They were really talking about that in a legislature, which freaked us all out, those of us who knew. And he would come back breathlessly every day, but, you know, who said what, and, you know, what was happening. So that was the milieu that all this stuff was happening in. And so basically the idea of pride, of having a pride, was sort of twofold. It was, one, get people active, get people engaged, get people to come together. Two, to show people that we were just normal people, you know, we're not some, you know, scary monster out there. And I had lived in Chicago before this, and I went to junior high and high school in Chicago. I'm Canadian, but we were there because my dad was in construction. So I had seen Pride in Chicago in 81 and 86, I think. I kind of was a little bit in the closet during high school, because everybody was in the closet during high school back then. And it was scary because after my first Pride parade in 81, I think, I remember reading this pamphlet, 500 people dead, nobody knows why, gay cancer. And this was before anybody talked about AIDS. So that's, you know, when you're 13 years old or 14 years old, however old I was, which is really young, to have that as your like first introduction to the gay world is terrifying. So that's, you know, but there was hope. That first parade I went to, there was hope. And that was partially what, you know, we wanted to instill with this. It was really a protest march. It wasn't so much a parade. It was a, you know, we're not going to take it lying down kind of thing. So that's what it came from.
So. Okay. How was the march different here from the ones that you had seen in Chicago?
Okay, so the one in Chicago was much...
Aside from they had, you know, 200,000.
Well, yeah, so it much bigger. I think the first Pride parade... Did I write it down? Hold on. Well, it was Jane Byrne was the mayor. She spoke at it. So that was one big difference, is they actually had buy-in from...
Already
from the people. I think it was like the 12th or 13th or something. I mean, it'd been going on for a while. There had been parades, obviously, in New York and Stonewall and stuff. There was stuff going on in San Francisco that I knew of. L.A. I didn't really know about very much, but I think I'd heard something. So there were things going on in the big cities anyway at the time in the States. So I'm going to say it's like the 12th or 13th parade or something that they had in Chicago. So it'd been going on for a while, and I don't know, it's probably 50, 60,000 people there. I mean, Chicago's a giant city anyway. It's like 8 million, 10 million people, but so it was a big parade and took up Halstead, like a big part in Chicago. And I used to go down in that area all the time, and there was a lot of activity. I used to go to this club back then. The drinking age was still 21 down there, so they had what they called juice bars. There's this juice bar called Medusa's, which was sort of infamous. It was very like a punk / goth scene, but there were a lot of preppy boys like me, which is really interesting. I would wear my like Levi's jeans and Sperry topsiders and Oxford button-down shirt from Brooks Brothers and a mohawk. Go to Medusa's. You can picture that. That, I mean, it was a very political kind of thing. Those kinds of groups. And I also used to, back then, a lot of the bars were also owned by the mob, or they paid VIG or what, you know, something to the mob. So you could bribe your way in. Like that, when I was, I think I went to Berlin when I was like 15 or 16. There was no way I looked like I was 21. But 20 bucks at the door, you got in, and if they said leave, you had to leave, because the cops were coming, you know? So I went. But only once in a while, and these were all very political spaces. Berlin had East and West Berlin's separated, but it was, East Berlin was outside underneath the L train, separated by like barbed wire, and then inside was West Berlin. It was the nice spot. but they always had drag shows, they always had political stuff going on, they always had pamphlets going out. So this is sort of like what I'm coming to it from, you know, is all this activism, essentially. And so the main difference between the parade was the size, the buy-in, because they had done quite a lot to reach out to a bunch of different people in the community. The alderman who were part of Boys Town. Boys Town would have been like Halsted, North Clark, and this little sort of enclave, this gay enclave, kind of like West Hollywood would be in L.A. or like Christopher Street would be in New York City, or, you know, that kind of a thing. But so the alderman there had already bought in, and they had brought in the mayor.
I would think that there were probably not any aldermen or city councilors. That marched in the first.
There were not. No, I think there were 50 or 60 people, something in there, maybe up to 75, but I don't even think that many.
Robin, you were there?
I walked on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
You were on the sidewalk?
And every once in a while I would run out.
There only was the sidewalk.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we didn't march in the streets.
And people shouted at us a couple times. And somebody got hit with a bottle or a can or something, because I remember somebody asking for like a wipes or something like that, you know, to clean up. But yeah, it was like that was it. And we did try to go through the official channels with the police and stuff, but at the time in Halifax, the police were still taking bribes from people. They definitely weren't doing anything about the violence on Citadel Hill or other places where, you know, cruising was going on. They'd rather arrest, you know, the person cruising than deal with any of the violence. Just generally, it was not conducive. Even at Dal, for instance, I think it was our third or fourth pamphlet we had put out. We had put up like notices for gays and lesbians at Dalhousie. It was the third or fourth one we put up. They said all queers must die or something. You know, written on all of the pamphlets, like 100 of them, all over campus. You know, so there was like a coordinated effort by somebody, and I don't think we ever figured out who, or if we did, I don't remember. You know, violence is okay against gays. So,
did you continue to work on later gay pride marches?
I worked on the 88 one, but then I moved in late 88, early 89, something like that, to Vancouver. I had a boyfriend who got transferred out there, and so I got a job out there too, which I lost on the airplane going there.
You lost a job on the airplane?
Yeah, well, the company I had been working for was a trust company, and they literally got bought out that day that I got on the airplane early in Halifax. They got bought out during the day, or the official buyout was during the day. They hadn't told me because I was a little nobody peon working for a giant company. They got bought out by a company in Toronto, and by the time I had landed in Vancouver and went in the next day for my first day, they were like, "No, you're fired. We just got bought." So it was a bad transition.
So you flew up there for nothing, really.
Well, I mean, for the boyfriend. Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's worth something.
What about in Vancouver or in later years, did you work on other pride parades?
I didn't. Well, that's not entirely true. I did work on sort of one. I worked for the film festival, and I worked for the Gay Games. I did quite a lot for the Gay Games. T-shirts, a bunch of marketing things, a bunch of the parade for that. The Gay Games at the time happened at the same time as the Pride Parade, so we sort of integrated both. There was a cultural festival, there was a movie festival. I was I want to say treasurer for that, or secretary for that. So I did quite a lot of work in Vancouver, and then later on, I did a little bit with I moved around quite a lot, so I moved sort of over to Vancouver and then down the coast. In Bellingham, Washington, I did a little bit for one of the AIDS groups there and an African dance group that had something to do with the gay community too. One of the people in it was in the gay community too. And then in Seattle, I just helped with there was a bar there. I helped at a couple events that were raising money for something. And then in LA, I did some stuff where there was a group called Lighthouse that, or well, it was Lighthouse then. I think it's a different name now. They did stuff for gay homeless kids, often kids with like runaways and stuff like that, often kids with other developmental issues. And so every year I would donate. I owned a catering company, and I would donate all the food. We just do it for free for that group. And then that would raise money. They would have an event once a year. It would raise money and stuff like that for that. For that group, so.
The march, as it was then, has now become a parade, as somebody already mentioned, with many businesses, unions, and other organizations taking part, and less political focus. What do you make of this?
Well, I think at the time when we started it, we did want buy-in from the community. I mean, like I said, I was coming to it from what I saw in Chicago, and I think it was the 85 or the 86 parade. Mayor Washington at the time in Chicago, you know, stood up to the KKK, they were pretty active back then in Chicago, at several marches.
Aryans,
yeah, And so he stood up to them and said, you know, I'm the mayor for everybody. And I remember that really sticking with me. And I think it was only the two pride parades I went to. But both of them, you either saw the mayor in the parade or you saw them actually making a speech, you know, coming out for gay rights, essentially, or, you know, human rights. So I think we did want buy-in like that, the political stuff. I remember in Washington State, in Seattle, they had a big pride parade there, and it was so boring. Oh my God, there were just 100 or 150 candidates for various offices, and they gave nothing to the parade. They were in a car with a little sign and, you know, some buttons or pamphlets or something about their positions, you know, to elect me for whatever, and it was just, there was no sense of real engagement with the community. There was no sense of, you know, I'm here in your parade, but I want to reach out and do these things to you, or what do you want me to do for you? There's no questioning, you know, no invite you to my town hall meeting and have you give me suggestions or anything like that. And so, to me, that kind of empty engagement isn't really engagement. I mean, it's nice that they're there, and it's nice that, you know, we form a constituency, I guess. So they're paying attention to us. But it's like a generic kind. It's not really paying attention to our issues. There's no sense of engagement with our issues, and I think we have a lot of issues coming down the road. For one thing, I'm all for having a parade in Halifax because it's a way to focus community. It's an event that a lot of people come to that wouldn't necessarily interact together. We've lost spaces in Halifax. It used to be, Rumors was like a real community space. So was the Turret. Now there's, for a while there was no gay bars in Halifax. Now there's two. There's Starlight and Rumors, which are just this year, I think, or maybe last year or something. So and we're losing things to the internet, to digital stuff. So we've got these kinds of spaces where you can be gay that are either individual or they're national or international in scope, but they're not local. And the Pride Parade is a local function with local people doing local things. So that is important for sure. It's a good way to bring people together, and that kind of getting the people together is part of the issue. You know, of generating the energy you need to make change. But we've moved the needle, but not turned the dial. People still. There's plenty of people out in Alberta or, you know, in the States that, you know, lump gay, lesbian, transgender, all this stuff together. We're really, in a sense, we're really different communities that have come together to support each other, which is wonderful. But we have some different priorities, and that's great. It's fine. We have to acknowledge that. We've got odd things coming down the road, like, in a sense, I think some of the people out there think of us as like the different people or the, you know,
the catch-all
of sexual deviancy, I suppose. You know, which is fine. I'm happy being a sexual deviant. I don't care. But what happens when people start having relationships with AI, which they are already doing? You know, what happens when robots get involved with that? That's 25 years or 50 years down the road, but it might happen. They already have crazy. I did some events for Playboy when I was catering in LA, and there's some interesting, really creepy dolls out there that will talk to you. It's a thing. Shopping. People pay like $5,000-$6,000 for them. Anyway, I'm just saying it's there. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. You know, what is that? Because it's not human to human interaction. There's the whole trans thing. There's only a male and a female. You know, with Trump, with Polyev. I don't see Polyev being a huge friend of our communities or community. As a whole, I don't believe that. I don't know. I don't know the man. I don't know all of his policies. But I think we have a lot of challenges coming down the road where we kind of have to get back out in front of that and say, we're not going to take it. We're not going to be shoved aside. We have a legitimate reason to be, and you can't use, you know, one of the things the right or the extreme right uses is a scapegoat, always, throughout history. I mean, you can go back to the Nazis, but you can go back all the way to the Romans and probably before that. You know, that they like to put a scapegoat out there, and this is, you know, these are the people you should go after. So the trans community is in huge danger. You know, so I think there are a lot of challenges coming forward that we need to be aware of and try to figure out ways either to use Pride as a gestation room to, you know, get something to bounce off of, you know, bring together ideas, bring together people who are really affected and give them some kind of political power, give them some kind of, you know, organize them in some way. You know, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. And I'm old and busted, so.
Hopefully Trump will have a heart attack next week.
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure Vance is any better.
No. Well, maybe he'll have a heart attack just seconds before he gets shot. So he'll get a double whammy.
We can't depend on the lotto, unfortunately.
Or let it play out. There's nothing like oppression.
I mean, that's the other thing is, you know, I remember the Reagan years, and we did some of our best work then, you know, with HIV/AIDS and other issues, sometimes that oppression is a way to focus the mind and, you know, bring people forward. And that could be good too. There are a lot of digital, internet specific things, Reddit, Substack, what, you know, those kinds of things that will bring communities together on that level. But I still think we should have also a local focus, as well as a national, international, provincial, you know, whatever other focuses. There's still plenty to do here. It's better. It's way better than when I was growing up. I remember in high school, there was this hot guy who used to sit in front of me in class. And I found out later that he had, you know, killed himself because he was gay. He was, you know, on the football team and, you know, the just one of those seemingly perfect people, you know, and
there you were
lusting after him. Yeah, 2 feet away from each other.
That if you had been out to each other, even
if we had been out to each other, exactly. And I wasn't out in high school. Like, I mean, I had a girlfriend. To be fair, I was going through, it was complicated for me for religious reasons. My parents were very religious. And for personal reasons to figure out what I was at the time. It did take me 4 or 6 years to really figure that out from the first time I got kissed behind the nurse's office. And when I was really out, when I came to Halifax and I was in university and suddenly had a lot of freedom and could really be myself. But in those intervening years, I was confused. I'm certainly not the first person to ever be that, you know, in your teenage years, I'm sure. So,
okay. I'm wondering, before we kind of break, where did Robin go? He disappeared. There he is. You were at that first march, weren't you?
I don't remember. I have to...
I think you were. I think you were. Yeah, you weren't at the meetings to organize it, but I think it was Maureen, myself, Mike Sangster, Kevin Crombie was at least at one. I missed one because I had some prior commitment. I think there were like 5, and I was at 4 of them. So Kevin Crombie was at least 1, maybe 2. There was somebody there. I keep wanting to say they had written a comic book or a graphic novel or were in the process of doing it, but I can't remember who they were. They were at least at one meeting.
A young guy.
And I don't know what happened to them. They sort of went by the wayside. But those are the people that I remember at the planning meetings. But Robin was there. He marched. He was in the march. And Mike was there in his paperback, too.
Which was in solidarity with somebody else who really had to wear a
because they were really worried about losing their job, and legitimately so.
Yeah.
You know, because it being out there, marching, doing the TV spots... You know, I was sidelined myself, and I was nobody. So I can't imagine somebody in a government position or, you know, we all know what happened to Eric Smith being kicked out of the school. So a school teacher, a government position, something like that, you know, it would have had serious consequences.
So I apologize for being late. I'm driving from Shea Harbor. What was the date?
Well, we got the year.
It was 87. It was late because it was late in the year.
Truth.
Yeah, it was late in the year because it was really cold. I remember being freezing. So I want to say like fall or even early winter.
Are you saying the night was in the fall? Was it? In the
And I think it was after that.
Oh, okay.
I haven't. At home, but I don't have it with
Because I know Maureen and Anne were involved with the Reclaim the Night thing, and that was, and LGRNS, which was Lesbian Gay Rights Nova Scotia. All of this, the Pride Parade was kind of half of it, was getting the community involvement and the people out there marching, getting a visible show of support. And then LGRNS, Lesbian Gay Rights Nova Scotia, was the political side of it, trying to get actual effective change in the government, neutralizing these people who were saying, you know, we want concentration camps for people with AIDS.
Which they did do, by the way.
LGRNS was very effective. Kevin was kind of the mole, you know, he was a reporter, but he got all the dirt. And so LGRNS was actually the second part of the parade at the time, really. The protest march, the visible side was the parade, and LGRNS was the political half of it that nobody really saw, except they were successful. And good on them. I wasn't as involved in that, I think partially because my time was too broken up with all these other groups that I was doing. But I do remember giving, I think we gave them some money. GAE might have given them some money from rumors.
I think one of the things that they did, but it's kind of vague, it might have been a different campaign. But at the opening of the legislature, they had a little brochure, and on the desk of every member of the legislature was this little brochure.
No, they
explaining
definitely
the rightness of.
No, they did a lot of really effective stuff, and because Kevin was there reporting and knew who the players were, they knew who to target when they were going and trying to talk to people directly to try to get change affected. And I think them and I think the PWA Society started
in 80. Started yet.
No, in 88.
Somebody from that
group got a commission to review the AIDS rights in 88, which did some really good work and had some gays and lesbians, you know, people on our side doing the AIDS portion. I think maybe it was either later that year or the next year that LGRNS got some legislation about. Yeah, go ahead.
Was it called a pride march or a pride?
I think we did use the name Pride, and partly that was in solidarity with the other things we knew. You know, we all knew about Stonewall and stuff that was going on, and I knew Chicago, and, you know, so Toronto, I think, was already doing it, and Montreal.
Did it start because people saying, you know, we should have a Pride parade, or did it start because we should have a march?
It was because we should have a march.
Yeah.
It was because we should have a march, but I think we did end up using the word. I remember the word pride at least being talked about in the meetings, and I think we did use that word because that's what we knew. It was already an established.
Yeah. Was there a specific focus in terms of like a demand or an area?
It was more bringing people together and trying to show. It was about visibility. There was no visibility at the time. I mean, I remember. There were several times, like when I was with Gays and Lesbians at Dal, we got a request from the Nova Scotia. It was basically like the social workers and stuff. They wanted somebody to talk about what life was like on campus, and they got somebody from high school, me, and I think, and they had somebody from grade school too, I think. And I thought when they first presented this thing, you know, come speak at our event, the way it was presented, I thought I was going to sit around on a couch with like 10 people. It was an auditorium with 250 professionals. Totally not what I was expecting. And one of the fraternity brothers that I was pledging that fraternity was there doing the sound and lights. So I was outed and got kicked out of, you know, the pledging class. Because that was just the 80s. I probably shouldn't have pledged anyway, but that's sort of what was done, you know, back in the day. And yeah.
Was it under a particular organization? Like, was it come up at a TA?
It was its own thing. They, Anne and Maureen. Well, they were starting LGRNS. And they wanted GAE involvement because I was basically tied to almost all the other gay and lesbian groups out there, either financially or, you know, just networking and stuff. So they wanted our input as a way to bring all these different groups together. And I, like I said, I was involved in like 12 groups at the time. So we had all that covered. We had coverage, basically. But it was always its own thing. It was always going to be... They got money, I think, from GAE for the first one. And might have gone into... We didn't have banners. We had picket signs. And I think we bought some, you know, stuff at the end of the Pride Parade. We ended up on, like... or that the Commons somewhere. It was just a little corner of it too.
No. Where we ended up, we marched up Spring Garden Road.
Yes, we were on Spring Garden.
And then we ended up outside the old gates to the public gardens.
Oh, you're right.
And we milled around in a circle. Yeah. None of us had thought to say, and we'll all go and have coffee at Zozo.
Yeah.
We had no place to go, and it was a Sunday, and things were much deader in Halifax on the Sunday.
Yeah, nothing
than
was open. But there might have been a second cup or something.
We went home.
Yeah, that's about what happened.
The next year it was better organized.
Can we go over again with the route? Where did it start?
You know, I really don't know. It's been so long. I know we were on Spring Garden because that's where we got some of the shouts.
Where was the club at that time?
The club had moved to Gottingen Street. By then, it had just.
No?
I think it had just
Are you
moved.
Sure?
I think
82.
No.
When it moved down to Granville, right?
It was Hollis first.
No.
I mean, it was the club was on Hollis at one point.
No, it was on Granville.
Was it? Or the entrance was on Hollis?
First one was on Barrington. That was the turret. Then
yep.
Changed name to Rumors and moved to Granville Street. And then kept the name Rumors and moved to Rockford Street.
Okay, all right.
Okay.
See, my memory's faulty. It's hard getting old.
So then we might have started out from.
We did not start. We
from
did not.
Street. We didn't start. From
I there. Don't think we did. I think we kind of did like a little bit of a loop, if
did
I recall.
Did you start at like Victoria Park or?
We started and ended at Parks. I remember that. Because we had to get together. We had to, you know, get our little.
Victoria Park.
That sounds like Victoria Park.
It probably was. I don't think we... I looked through my stuff. I don't have a route plan or anything
then
like that.
We don't have one photograph from it. That's what happened. Because the photograph was taken the following year, and everybody could see the photograph of the key.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, I think Jim DeYoung was there, and he took... either a video or a photograph or something like that. So it's possible that's still in whatever archive his stuff is in.
That's at my house.
Okay, so that's possibly there. Because I do remember him with some kind of camera video device, something like that.
Then Lynn said something I didn't catch earlier about going around the circle or something. That you said we had gathered at the public garden, went up the garden, went to the public garden's gates, and then...
No, I just meant that we were milling around.
Yeah, we were milling around, yeah.
Yeah, not going around the circle, really.
Yeah, I definitely
Although
remember that.
There is now a circular flower bed there, but I'm not at all sure that it was there at that time. Right.
It was a transitional time in a lot of ways because the rumors was moving from Granville to Goddard, and there was also I was going through major burnout, so I wasn't as involved in things until there was a crisis in Gala, and GAE changed its name to Gala.
Right, yeah, that was that year.
I was withdrawn from it, and then I got pulled back into it because the board resigned, and I came on with a bunch of other people. On the board.
We didn't resign, we were fired.
What do you mean we were fired?
We were fired.
By whom?
There were some financial irregularities at the club. Basically, we weren't paying all of our bills, and we fired Scott McNeil for that. I couldn't figure out. I was the treasurer and then the vice chair, and I couldn't figure out what was going on with the books. And when we finally got into the office, he wouldn't let me see the books. And when we finally got in, I figured it out. It's like, well, I don't have all the bills. That's what's going on. So we fired him for good reason, but Jim DeYoung and other people really didn't like that because they were really good friends and started a push to get us out and fired us. Which I get the stand up for your friends thing, but I felt quite used by that. But anyway, that happened, and then I was involved in other things, and then I moved like a year after that, or 8 months or something, 9 months after that.
Was Scott the manager twice?
I don't know. They might have rehired him. I was long gone in Vancouver at the time. He was the first.
Because
he was the manager in Granville. And then we moved from Granville to Gottingen, and there were problems with Gottingen.
And then he was manager again in Gottingen.
He was the manager in Gottingen, and then we fired him, and then he might have been the manager after. He might have been reinstated, I don't know.
No.
But there were problems at Gottingen specific to Gottingen, I think regarding like liquor deliveries and cops and all kinds of stuff. I mean, there was a lot going on. It was a much larger building. We owned it, so we had a mortgage, and so the financial stuff was way bigger than most people wanted to handle. And I was like, I don't know, I started at GAA, I might have been like 19 or 20, you know, and then Gala 21, 22, something like that, you know, like so I was young, but I was handling, you know, the finances for a club.
Is this the paper bag march, or is that a...
That's the paper bag. I think it happened both times. I think the 88, I think some people wore, because things hadn't improved that much. The first march was the protest to kind of get it started, and unfortunately, even though I had reached out to everybody I knew, and I know Anne and Maureen had reached out to everybody they knew, we had like 60 people, maybe at best we had 75, and I don't think that's true.
I thought it was around 50 or something.
I think it's closer to 50. I don't think we ever had a count. We weren't well organized. We tried to get organized, but it was like cats herding cats.
And a lot of people were.
And a lot of people were
afraid.
Really. I mean, this is the very beginning, so the very seed, and people were terrified. You know, they were worried about violence. They were worried about their jobs, and you know, they were. Yeah, and they were worried about the political blowback of it. Like, what happens if we...
Worried about media coverage and your mother might see you.
Right, right. Exactly, you know.
And siblings.
Or worse, yeah, your cousins who would float around to all the rest of the family.
I had that happen. You know, a friend of mine, David, part of a well-to-do family in the Valley, they found out he was gay and basically cut him off, you know, and... few years later, I was taking care of him along with a couple of other friends of his out in Vancouver while he was dying of AIDS. And I remember them, when he died, they came into the house, took all of his stuff, and left. They didn't say anything. They didn't say thank you. they didn't say, you know, we're going to have a memorial, nothing. That's what I remember, you know. And that was a few years after this march, you know, the conservative, wealthy family. And so that's what we were up against. And so I understand why people didn't want to put themselves out there. It was scary, you know, and had real consequences.
It's so different now in a lot of ways because you look at television, there's gay characters here, there, and everywhere. And
I think at the time we had had, there was that one with like Michael Ankin and the guy from L.A. Law or something.
It might have been just beginning.
Yeah, there were like a couple little things. Boys in the Band might have been out. I don't know.
Oh, that was a bit.
Yeah.
Even.
Yeah. So there was a couple little things going on. I think Torch Song Trilogy came out in like, I want to say 88 or something. Parting Glances came out around the same time. There wasn't much.
So that's one way of things, that things are different. There are many more people like in government and politics and so on who are gay positive or gay neutral. But on the other hand,
yeah.
You got Donald Trump and his buddies.
Exactly.
And rest assured, there's plenty of those buddies in Canada too. Who will come out of the woodwork if Paul ever gets elected.
Yeah, and he probably will. I mean, that's unfortunately the reality.
We have to work really hard to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Yes.
Because it's a real possibility.
Because seriously, any of the above would be better.
What's going to happen, right, the next time any of the people in this room decide to go down to the States for a visit? Well, why would you move anyway?
Well, I literally moved here because I wanted to get away.
For all you know, in a year's time, you'd be stopped at the border. Because who are all his buddies, right? Are these great controllers of information?
Yeah.
And they will have our names. Of course they will.
And he's going to fire everybody that's working now and bring in all ones that are on his side.
Yeah.
That being said, option one is to sit around, see Polyev being elected, see our rights being stripped away, and see us being pushed back into a corner and then going, oh gosh, this is terrible. Who could have seen it? Except that here we are.
Here we are talking about it, so we saw it.
What is option two? What is option two, rather than just waiting for our lives to be oppressed? What do we do in advance of that? This is a thing that I spent a great deal of time on, partly because my mom is a Holocaust survivor, and her parents thought about that in 1937 and 38 and said, you know what? There's a crazy man in the country next door threatening to do all kinds of horrible things, and everybody else is saying, that's dumb. He could never possibly do that. But what?
Well, yeah, and there's a crazy man next door talking about making Canada another state.
Yeah. This is a modern day Hitler.
You know?
It's a massive private army.
Yeah.
I'm alive because my grandparents said, what if that happens?
Yeah.
Let's just take some action.
So I guess option one is move. I don't know where to. It's not
Greenland?
Safe for...
Yeah.
No, not Greenland.
Not Panama.
Not Panama.
Mars.
Not Mars. Yeah. Option two is getting involved in other... You know, one of the more effective things we can do is band together. Mayor Washington in Chicago at that... 85, 86, whatever it was, parade, was from the black community and was a black rights, you know, supporter. So combine the different groups, come together. There, you know, it's not just us who are going to be affected anyway. So either join or combine with or invite to meetings people from other affected communities. Bring, like we tried to do with that march, bring people together, create a critical mass of effective political resistance. Because you can't, there's no way to do it alone that I know of. And the only things I've been successful in are targeted. It's when you have a very specific goal and you go after it kind of monomaniacally, and put other things aside. You know, for a while there's a group of restaurants and stuff that feed the homeless in LA, and I did that for a few years. Well, I did that pretty much all the years that I had my company, because I lived in Venice Beach, and there's a lot of homeless on the beach there, and so we'd feed like 1,000 people. But it was always like throwing good money after bad. You know, it wasn't actually solving anything. It was nice for a day that some homeless people got some good food, but it was always throwing after something. When I started helping with Spotlight, or Searchlight, I was targeting my efforts at one specific organization, getting people off the street, out of prostitution. You know, these young kids, sometimes like 13, 12, you know, often with different other issues going on, emotional stuff or like ADHD or those kinds of things as well, trying to get them adopted. You know, it's like when you focus your efforts into one much smaller group and try to, you know, catch it, that was way more effective, I felt. A way more effective use of my time, way more effective for the actual people that I wanted to help. So I always advocate narrowing stuff down. Like I don't know if we can stop Polyev from being elected, but we probably can get the government we want here in Nova Scotia or in Halifax. Yep.
I wanted to say a couple of things. I mean, and I'm glad that brought this up in my humor, the way you were supposed to do as well, Dan. But first of all, I think that, I mean, I'm trained in history, and the first thing I can say I've learned in history is that nobody knows what's going to happen.
No, we don't.
But I'm assuming that things are not going to go on the way they are, or that we're used to, that business as usual is done. I don't know what's going to happen, but it's going to be very, very bad. And I don't assume, like people always say, well, what about the midterm elections? Well, I don't think we can assume there will be midterm elections. Or if there are midterm elections in the US, that they'll actually be elections and not simply a formal show.
To that point, there was a woman in, I think it was Nebraska or something, that was a qualified elected, and they're trying to overturn her election, even though she won by 66,000 points or something. You know, so they're trying to overturn her official election. They're stealing her election. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Sarah Worthman, who's a queer historian from Newfoundland, who's doing research into queer history in World War I, she and I have met, and she and talked about how to organize resistance. And she's leading, trying to set up a national network of people who started with Stop Me Polyev. Now, so far that network has run predominantly queer and trans, but I think that we should be, maybe there's other people in this room who might like to meet and form a committee to talk about this. I think that we should also then start talking to other groups, like who else is recognized as, like, are there people in the African Scotian community, are there organizations, for example?
MCMAC, maybe?
Pardon?
Micmac, maybe?
Yeah, indigenous communities, yep. Et cetera. I think there's lots of people who are aware. I mean, it's not only the danger of Polyev, but Polyev in the context of Trump.
Yeah.
Fascism is alive in North America, and that this threatens everybody. And so we need to look where we can start building. But yes, we start locally with our community, but we should reach out to other communities.
Building bridges.
I don't think we can assume anything about the upcoming election. Now, I've moved to Blue Sky, which is very much a bubble. So, if you on Blue Sky, it's very hard to call the outcome ever been. But things have changed with Trudeau's resignation, with whoever he's going to face. I mean, we have two really very qualified candidates, and each of them has weaknesses, of course, as everybody does. But they're two extremely qualified people running for the Liberal leadership. And with the change of leadership and the change of the situation with Trump, I don't think we should assume that Poilievre is going to do that. Also, the things he's been running on for the last 6 months have been taken away from him. Anti-Trudeau, well, Trudeau's not there anymore. Carbon tax, well, you know, carbon tax isn't going to be the issue. He's facing one of two very qualified, very skilled people, and who've also said, indicated in the last couple of days, that they will support each other.
Yep.
Like whoever wins the Liberal leadership will also be supported by the person who doesn't win the leadership.
Yep.
We should certainly hope at least that Poilievre doesn't get a majority, but we shouldn't even assume that he's going to get a minority.
I think it's actually going to be a little worse than that, and I'm sorry to be a Debbie Downer here, I think it kind of the carbon tax and the anti-Trudeau are issues, but I don't think that's how it's going to go, because that's not, you know, Kamala brought forth some pretty good points, you know, in her election. I think it's the anger and the economy, and I think if Trump is, and I think he is, really going to do economic warfare against Canada in some way to try to force us to be another state. I mean, it's not a perfect analogy, but you know, when Rome's center of power moves to Byzantium, and you know, this isn't Rome, this isn't Byzantium, but they take over other stuff. You know, Trump's positions are going to be, I want to fight somebody because then there's an external enemy. I want to have a scapegoat. It's the same thing that's happened throughout history. The Nazis, you could go through a bunch of different things. And I think that it's the anger in the economics above and beyond specific issues like carbon tax, although that's an issue, that's going to drive this stuff, and it's already got steam behind it, and I hope it doesn't work. I hope he doesn't get in. I hope we can stop him from getting in. I don't want to rely on that.
Well, no, and I, as I said, I'm not predicting the future, but I'm saying we should not assume that he's going to get in. There's also a danger in going around saying, he's going to win, because everybody's saying, he's going to win. Well, he'll win if everybody goes around saying he's going to win.
That's right.
Yep.
And then
they
won't vote.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I don't think we should assume that's a given. Also, yes, the center of gravity politically has moved way to the right, and that will bring a certain number of people in Canada with it.
Yep.
But not everybody in Canada is going to go that way. It also gives rise to the opposition. And there's I think it's notable that while like the Premier of Alberta has gone far right to be close to the center of gravity, the Conservative Premier of Ontario has not. He's gone in the other direction. His flag he's been raising is that we have to oppose the Americans with full force.
Yeah.
So
and I agree.
and so I think there's going to be movements in both directions, and what the balance is going to be is what's going to determine the election coming up, and who people feel is going to be present a credible plan for dealing with the situation. Whether dealing with the situation is getting on board the Trump bandwagon or mobilizing all of our forces, Canadians, to oppose it.
Well, I mean, you know, if you go back to something like the Nazis, for instance. Effective strategies there was some pretty effective resistance. You know, everybody thinks the Nazis just sort of went ahead and won in a wave of power. I think they won by like a vote or two votes or something originally, and it was political violence, like you saw with the Proud Boys and stuff in January 6th, and it was also disallowing like the communist vote and stuff in Germany that allowed them to take complete control. Without those two things, the political violence stopping people from protesting, and the and this ability they had to, you know, to cancel out the votes of a bunch of people. There was, the communists were very powerful back then. You know, he had all kinds of labor problems and stuff going on. So, and it was really about the labor. It wasn't communism the way we think of it today with China and Russia. It was a different sort. So without those two things, the Nazis would not have been in power. So working against those two things, political violence is something we could do something about if it does happen here, and it could, arrest them, throw them in jail. Don't let them out like Trump did.
Oh, I was just going to add, the Trudeau government, Proud Boys were made a terrorist organization. That could be reversed.
It could be reversed, exactly, but we don't want it to be. So working, you know, on that legal side, making sure people are enfranchised, creating links between various stakeholders in our community and other communities that will be affected, like...
Yeah. Well, our electoral system and our judicial system are not compromised in the way they are in the United States.
Not yet, but we have to guard against it.
Yes, we do. And I mean, anything could change given enough time, but we're not in the same situation as
America. No, we're not.
We're in everyone on the planet is in grave peril, but we're not in the same situation. We have a lot more politically within Canada, constitutionally, in terms of, like, we have an electoral system that's arm's length from the government and run to enable as many people as possible to vote. Like, Elections Canada wants everybody to go vote.
Yeah.
Whereas the electoral system in the United States is to prevent anybody from voting if it's a Republican. And the judicial system has been severely compromised, and will be much more so. With the second term of Trump. Yeah. I'm not optimistic about the... I mean, eventually, I believe Trumpism will fall, but I'm not optimistic in the short term about American resistance. I think it's going to be very, very, very bad in the U.S. But we are in grave peril, and we should know what the peril is, but it's a very different situation.
Yeah. The darkest cloud on... Yep, sorry.
I don't want to stop people in their tracks, but I also want to find out what time it is, because
yes,
we do have...
Yes, after two.
Okay.
So we're good for another
40
half
minutes.
An hour or
yeah,
so.
Half an hour, yeah.
And I think it's important to carry on this conversation. And in fact, the idea of, I'm sure I heard it there someplace, getting together a group of people to discuss what we ought to be doing to start being activists now and not when we're in dire straits.
Yeah.
I think that's very important. And before we continue on with that, though, I would just like to give a few thanks. First of all, to Nathan for coming.
Thank you for having me.
All these memories, which I was there, but I didn't remember a lot of that stuff. I wasn't on his committee for one thing. Also, thanks to Dan for tech support. There's tech support on three legs here. Thanks to those who helped with local arrangements and to those who provided refreshments. And thanks to Northwood for letting us have this fine meeting space free of charge, as they have done for quite some time.